I'm Peter Linus, and I work at the American Friends Service Committee, and want to welcome you all to the first Tuesday forum for our traveling exhibit called Windows and Mirrors, Reflections on the War in Afghanistan. And I know some of you were here last Thursday for the opening, where we had a short presentation with some of the artists. But I do want to encourage you all to take some time after the presentation to look again at the murals. I've found, being in this room a couple times now, that every time I walk around these walls and look at the artwork, I'm moved in a different kind of way. To give you a sense of what's happening next, it's going to be here in Philadelphia for 1 month, and then it's going to a gallery in New York for December, and then it will be out in the West Coast, where it will be divided into two shows in two different galleries in Los Angeles. And then it's going to Guilford College, which is in North Carolina. Several of the panels were created by students at Guilford. And then it's going to Chicago and Indianapolis, and we're intending to tour this for the next 2 years. And so this is the first time that it's been displayed publicly, and we see ourselves as a test run to figure out ways that we can use the artwork as a way to attract people to come to learn more about the war in Afghanistan and ways that we can work together to end it. So that's ultimately our goal. We will have Tuesday evening forums for the rest of the month. So next week we'll be meeting and discussing Islam and Islamophobia. The week after that we will be looking at civilian casualties in Philadelphia and talk about restorative justice and some of the organizations that are working in communities here with young people, and that should be exciting. And then on Friday, November 5th, we will have 8 of the artists coming here and talking about their goals and objectives in creating their different murals. So I think it'll be very, very exciting. But tonight's event is entitled Ending the War, Understanding the Alternatives. We wanted to create these public forums to give people more of an opportunity to listen to the alternatives and have some dialogue with experts that we've invited to make short presentations. One thing we don't want to do with the exhibit is just have buzzwords that mean certain things to certain people. And it's one thing to say there are alternatives, but we want to spend this evening talking about the alternatives and spelling out what we can do and missed opportunities that we've had. So I'm very excited that we have two wonderful speakers. Before we get started, I simply want to mention some of the co-sponsors that have helped us pull together these activities. The key sponsors have been the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting Peace and Social Concerns Committee, and they've been great, and the Envision Peace Museum. And I'll just quickly read through who some of our partners are here in Philadelphia to give you a sense of who we're trying to reach out to and look at these issues. The Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program, the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania, the Quaker Affairs Office at Haverford College, Veterans for Peace, Brandywine Peace Community, the Catholic Peace Fellowship, House of Grace Catholic Worker, the Community Cultural Exchange, Bread and Roses Community Fund, Lehigh Pocono Committee of Concern, the Grannies Peace Brigade, U.S. Labor Against War, and the Faculty and Staff Federation of Community College of Philadelphia. And we're hoping they'll each engage in different ways on different panels. So those are the introductions. The two speakers tonight will be Oscar Castro, who is a peace-building analyst for the American Friends Service Committee, and he'll be followed by Phyllis Bennis, who directs the new internationalism project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Although we are in a Quaker meeting, applause are allowed, and we will have questions, and we'll have an opportunity to ask some questions following the speaker. So just kind of think about what Oscar stimulates in you and save your thought. Then we'll hear from Phyllis, and then we'll have some back and forth and some questions. So here's Oscar Castro.
I like applause. That's great. Thanks, Peter. And I kind of feel, I was joking with Phyllis and Peter, I kind of feel like I'm the opening act, and respectfully so, because I show as much deference as I can to Phyllis, who really I think is an A-plus analyst when it comes to the deeper understanding of these things. And so my remarks will be very brief, but hopefully to the point, as I do my best to frame this from a perspective that I think not too many people are capturing. And the reason why these murals exist has a lot to do with the fact that a war exists. And so on October 7th, 2001, the invasion of Afghanistan, entitled Operation Enduring Freedom, began. It started out as the good war to many, as it was sold to the public as a response to the acts that occurred on September 11th, 2001. Despite the catastrophe that is the war in Afghanistan, there are many who still believe that it is the good war. It was an easy sell, with the notion of revenge being taken for the fallen, and the reason it was such an easy thing to do is because the U.S. public, dyed in the wool of militarism, has no idea such pathology shrouds their minds. For nearly the last 24 years, the American Friends Service Committee has been addressing this problem, but from a very unique vantage point. We are a lot older than 24 years. If you have ever had the pleasure of listening to The Greatest Love of All, sung by George Benson, then you might agree with the opening verse, which I will not sing, but I will recite for you. I believe the children are our future. And it is this notion that many of us share, which has been the driving force behind AFSC's work to demilitarize a nation by working to demilitarize the minds and lives of its youth. So we are here to talk about ending the war in Afghanistan and understanding the alternatives. And I'd like to introduce this presentation by framing it in such a way that not only can we examine, with the help of our esteemed guests, the ways in which the U.S. can cease its destructive military activities and flawed foreign policies, but also to examine the possibility of a nation that does not allow its leaders to rush to war so easily in the first place. Across the nation, there are now thousands of individuals struggling to see this become a reality by addressing the ways in which the youth of their communities are militarized. Some of them are in this room tonight. It does not take much to see the variety of ways in which our youth are introduced to the U.S. military. Whether it is through single-minded military recruiters interested in their own professional self-preservation, military training programs in our public schools, the internet and television advertisements glorifying military service, movies and television shows that venerate those who wear military uniforms, or memorial parades that have turned from events of solemn remembrance to idolization of the military, our nation's youth are constantly bombarded with the idea that the military has to be the biggest and the best on the block in order to preserve our freedoms. Whether one enlists in the military or not, because of this barrage of militaristic messages, the ultimate goal of those marketing the public face of the U.S. military is to have a nation that does not critically analyze the armed forces or how they are used. And so when we speak of ending a war, let us begin by thinking of ways to end, as President Franklin Roosevelt said, the beginning of all wars, through the enlightenment of our youth and the demilitarization of their minds and their lives. When we speak of alternatives to war, let us begin by thinking of ways to provide alternatives for all our youth who seek to be of service, earn a living wage, and advance themselves in the human continuum without having to be enslaved to an 8-year contract that binds them. The invasion of Afghanistan did not have to happen. And if we had the democracy that so many believe the military is here to defend, then perhaps a different approach might have been taken, because the people would have cried for peace and not war. Peace was the road not taken. And that is because this nation has, generation after generation, been taught that our military might is what keeps us free. Ending the war in Afghanistan is more than just about Afghanistan. It is also about what comes afterwards 10, 20, 30 years from now. Will we continue to be a militaristic-minded nation that dares not question the national authority, or one that desires a different standing among nations? How we end the war the U.S. has chosen to wage in Afghanistan, and how we address the rising tide of militarism in our lives, will be very relevant to the future generations and future leaders of this nation, whose fingers will be on the war button. Thank you.
Okay, before Phyllis speaks, I want to say that she's a prolific writer. She is the key analyst for one of the larger peace coalitions in the United States called United for Peace and Justice. And one thing she's done is write several primers around conflict to help us understand the scaffolding around the root causes. We have primers that she's written on Afghanistan, how to get the U.S. out of Afghanistan, as well as Israel-Palestine and Iraq, that are available for $10. So I'm hoping that after you hear her speak, you will want more details on her thinking, and you can get that through her book. Phyllis Bennett.
Thank you all. It seems no matter where I show up to speak, somebody a foot taller than me has gone first. I was in Detroit not too long ago, and speaking at this very big church, and it was, you know, a big mic and a big sound system, but there was a break, and the woman who was the pastor of the church came running up on stage to adjust the microphone, and then she looked at me and she said, "Would you like to stand on a box?" And I said, "Am I a bar mitzvah boy here? This is what I remember when I was a kid, you know?" Anyway, thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you to the AFSC for their courage, their moral leadership, their not letting the peace movement get away with anything, which is what we look to AFSC for. And thank you to the Arch Street Meeting House for giving us this extraordinary space. I came in tonight to see the exhibition, and it really is quite stunning. It's to speak in this environment is a whole different thing than to speak in an ordinary church basement. And I'm very grateful for that. I think this is going, over the next 2 years, to have an extraordinary impact on how people in this country come to understand these wars. You know, as we commemorated last week the 9th anniversary of the U.S. attack on Afghanistan, the question that Oscar was just raising, I think, has been at the forefront of much of the discussion, but not nearly deeply enough, which was, how did we get into this? And it is true, an awful lot of people at the beginning thought this was the good war. You all, I'm looking around the room, and I see everybody here is old enough to remember what it was like after September 11, the fear that gripped this country. This was unprecedented. We had never been attacked like this in the living memory of on the mainland of the United States. Even Pearl Harbor it was a military base, and of course it wasn't a state yet. But it was a moment unimaginable fear. And what's frightening to think about was that this was a country whose population was more or less prepared to follow any leader that gave us leadership, that told us what we were going to do. And what we got, once he finished reading My Pet Goat to the second graders, what we got was a call to war. And there was this sense of, yeah, that's what we do. And I think that understanding it in the context, as Oscar put it, I think is crucial, the legacy of militarism in this country. But part of me also wants to give people in this country a little bit more credit and say part of the reason that we chose to follow that insanity was because the only alternative we were presented with was, are we going to go to a war or are we going to let them get away with it? And let them get away with it was not exactly a viable option. The notion that what had happened on September 11 was a huge crime, not an act of war. It wasn't one country going to war against us. It was a crime, a huge crime, a crime against humanity. People needed to be held accountable and brought to justice. But that's very different than responding as if it had been a country going to war with us. These guys were not Afghans. They came from Saudi Arabia and Egypt, our two strongest allies in the Middle East. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't go to school in Afghanistan. They went to school and trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So what the hell were we doing bombing Afghanistan? Because they were inspired by some guy there, who by this time, I'm pretty convinced, has shaved his beard and is living somewhere in the south of France. Or should be, if, you know. But it is important to remember that not everybody fell into that trap. It was small, but from the very beginning, there was an organization that very quickly rose up and claimed their position, the September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, who went off to Afghanistan to meet with their counterparts and say, we know what's coming for you and we dread it, and not in our name. Not in our name. And that became a watchword for a movement that did grow up. On the day, October 7, 2001, on the day that the U.S. went to war against Afghanistan, that was the day of the first national peace mobilization against going to war in Afghanistan. We didn't know that was the day the war would start, but we knew it was coming, we knew it was imminent, and it happened in New York. It was at Union Square, and there were a few thousand people there. You had to be pretty brave to come out that day in New York City, because the whole city at that point, which had been the centerpiece of this attack, the whole city was terrified. You saw it at the United Nations when they had met the day after the attacks and passed unanimously the resolution that the U.S. drafted. And emotions were running so high that instead of just raising their hand to vote, the ambassadors each stood up to cast their vote. I mean, it's not surprising. They lived in New York, too, just a few miles from Ground Zero. They had family and friends in the area. Some had lost relatives already. Others didn't know yet what had happened to their families. It was a terrifying moment. And they voted unanimously to support whatever the U.S. wanted. And here's where we get to the question about the legitimacy of this war, the good war, the war of self-defense, the war of the firefighters, you know, the war of those brave people. It was never about that. Because, you know, the UN Charter is a great document. I spend a lot of my time defending the UN Charter in all kinds of weird arenas. But the UN Charter is pretty vague about a lot of stuff. But it's very clear about a few things. And one of the few things it's very clear on is, when is it legal to go to war? And it's clear because the answer is almost never. There's only two times when it's legal to go to war. One is if the Security Council says so. That's what happened in 1990 when the U.S. bribed and threatened and punished every country on the Security Council trying to get a unanimous vote. They didn't, but they got an overwhelming vote supporting the first U.S. war against Iraq back in 1991. So as much as it was immoral and illegitimate, we can't really argue that that was an illegal war because they had illegally used a legal mechanism. It's one way to talk about it. It's a little convoluted, but you get my point. This time around, they didn't ask for that to be approved. And it's an important thing to remember because it's not a situation where they didn't ask because they were afraid they wouldn't get support. They knew they would get a unanimous vote for whatever they asked for on that day. But remember, this is less than 24 hours after the attacks. Well, it was just about 24 hours. People were still terrified. They would have given the U.S. anything. If the U.S. had asked for an authorization for war, that would have been a unanimous vote, too. The reason it didn't happen is because the U.S. didn't ask for it. Why didn't they? Not because they were afraid they wouldn't get it, but because they didn't want to acknowledge that it is indeed the U.N. Security Council that has the only authority to make a war legal. They didn't want to acknowledge that authority of the United Nations. So they didn't ask. Now, the second way that a war can be legal is self-defense. And we heard a lot about self-defense. There is a right to self-defense. Article 51 of the UN Charter is very clear about what is self-defense. But it's not an absolute right. You can't say, oh, we were attacked a few weeks ago by somebody who came from somewhere, so we're going to take the world to war indefinitely, against anybody we choose, wherever we want, for as long as we wish, using whatever weapons we have available. That's not self-defense. That's a war of aggression. And that's what this was. It was a war of aggression. So the alternative was not let them get away with it. The alternative was unite with people around the world, with police agencies around the world. I wrote a book about what 9/11 represented in terms of U.S. foreign policy. It was called Before and After. And one of the great things I got to do in that book was to write the speech that George Bush should have given that day when he finished reading My Pet Goat. And I started by saying, this is what teaches us. This is how we learn that what is important is cooperation. This is why we realize now we were wrong not to support the International Criminal Court. This is why we need an International Criminal Court. This is why we need a court that's empowered, that has police capacity to go after people in all parts of the world who cannot be held accountable in any other way. This is why we need the United Nations to be stronger than ever. This isn't why we need to go to war. That, as you know, was not the speech that George Bush gave, but it does get to this question of what was the alteration that happened after 9/11. And in my view, September 11 didn't change the world. It changed the lives of a lot of people. It was a horrifying reality, almost 3,000 people killed and their families, friends. I mean, it was horrifying. But did it threaten the United States? No. Did it threaten our democracy? No. But what threatened the United States and threatened our democracy and continues to threaten us all today was not September 11, but September 12th. September 12th, when George Bush announced that in response to this crime, we're going to take the world to war. That's what has turned the world against us. You know, remember the level of support that we got all around the world. This is after, remember, the first months of the Bush administration, he wasn't exactly a popular guy already, way before 9/11. You know, one of the things that was already happening, the French intellectuals were starting to talk about the U.S. as a hyperpower, not just a superpower, but a hyperpower. The French, I mean, this was an amazing thing. The U.S. lost its seat in the U.N. Human Rights Commission. Unprecedented. The U.S. never lost its seats in the U.N. It lost its seat. Why? Because the rest of the world was just fed up with hypocrisy and double standards. So they voted for Sweden instead of the U.S. Sounded right to me. The U.S. lost its seat on the Drug Enforcement Agency at the U.N. This never happens. All of a sudden, 9/11 happens, and all around the world there is solidarity, human solidarity with us. The French newspapers are saying, nous sommes tous américains maintenant. We are all Americans now. The French. I mean, this never happens, the French. But what happens? That's squandered. That's squandered by a war that has made us less safe, has made us hated, has made the instruments of international accountability weaker. So we have the war going on now for 9 years, going into its 10th year. And we're at this amazing moment where people are starting to talk about this war in a whole different way. The Bob Woodward book is helping a lot on that debate. Now, I'm no great fan of these Bob Woodward books that, you know, everybody, once they get out of the White House, they're trying to recast history to make themselves look good. That's basically what they're about. But sometimes they can be pretty important. This one, I think, is pretty important. I got to say, I haven't bought it yet. I'm waiting for the paperback because I don't want to give him all that money. I just, you know. But there's been a lot of great excerpts of it in the Washington Post. And you read those excerpts, and it's amazing. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's kind of amazing about it. The fact that one of the big things the U.S. has been doing is creating an Afghan special forces unit that is basically accountable only to Hamid Karzai personally, no accountability to the rest of the Afghan military. It's like a personal militia that's being trained by the same guys that we are sending to use drones, to kill civilians, all in the name of going after terrorists. There's an expanded CIA role that has not been public in Afghanistan as well as in Pakistan. So there's a lot of problems here. And then on top of that, there's all the information about this constant fighting that President Obama is losing between the White House and the military. Now, this is a big problem because what we have is a president who, for whatever reasons of his own, and we can argue over whether it was true, but he believed that if he was going to be the anti-war president, he was going to end the war in Iraq, maybe, we'll see. But to do that, he was going to have a war he could call his own. And that was going to be the Afghanistan War. And he was going to have generals that were his generals, that were his guys, that were saying, yes, this is militarily feasible and is right. Well, he had generals. He had General Jim Jones. He had General Eikenberry. He had a bunch of generals who did not want to escalate. But he chose the other generals. He chose General McChrystal. And then when it got too out of control, he had to fire General McChrystal and replaced him with General Petraeus, who, of course, is the granddaddy of this counterinsurgency strategy that they claim won the war for the U.S. in Iraq and now is going to win the war for us in Afghanistan. Yeah, well, we'll see about that. But what's so dangerous is that what's clear is Obama had come to the generals and said in that four-month period when he was trying to figure out what was his Afghanistan strategy going to be, this is after, let's not forget, his first act around Afghanistan just weeks after taking office, when he says, okay, we're going to send 21,000 more troops right now. Then we'll figure out a strategy. Hello? How backward is that? How backward is that when you say, we're going to send the troops first and then figure out what they're going to do there? This is way wrong. But that's, in fact, what happened. Then he had this four-month period. And I'll tell you, I was at the White House for one of those meetings. And I think it was true. It was a weird meeting, and I can tell you about it sometimes. But whatever it was, it was. The bottom line is they weren't listening to us. But they were desperate. We were meeting with kind of mid-level guys, military guys, in the National Security Council. And they were desperate for alternative strategies. They didn't know what to put forward. Well, now we know that what was going on was that President Obama had said to the military, you need to provide me with some new strategies. I want a strategy based on withdrawal, based on getting these troops out of there. And they said, no, we can't. And he said, you go back and do it. And they came back and said, can't be done. And instead of saying, all right, you're out, I'm going to find a general who can, he just said, okay, then tell me what can be done. And they said, well, we need 40,000 new troops and an escalation, and we're going to be there for years. And he said, that's not acceptable. But instead of going back to what he knew was right, which was no escalation and get the troops home, he said, all right, we'll compromise, the great compromiser. So he didn't give them the 40,000 troops that they wanted. He only gave them 30,000. Great. Only $33 billion for that escalation. $33 billion? It's one of those numbers. Has anybody here seen a million anything? See, I'd beat you on this. When I was in second grade, I had a teacher who wanted to teach us math. And she said, I'm going to show you a million things. And you keep watch because never again in your life are you ever going to see a million anything. And I remember it to this day. She hung a sheet of graph paper, the tiny little squares where it's like 10 squares to the inch each way. And she put up 1,000 inches by 1,000 squares by 1,000 squares and said, look there, there's a million little squares. That's the only time you're ever going to see a million. But basically, $33 billion, it might as well be a gazillion for all it means anything. But here's a trick. You compare it to something, and then it means something. $33 billion, that's enough for 660,000 new green jobs. Thank you. The lights are agreeing with me. It's, you know, it's stunning, the waste of money for something that is not keeping us safe. Look at the cost another way. It cost $1 million a year to keep one young soldier in Afghanistan. Why? Not because the soldier's getting all that money. Half the soldiers qualify for food stamps. It's because of what it costs to get gasoline for the tanks and ammunition for the M16 and all of that. $1 million. For $1 million, you could hire that soldier and 19 more for a good green union job, a living wage job to support a family. What's going to keep us safer? You know, it's one of these you do the math moments. So we're hearing these new discussions. We're hearing about the cost of war in a whole different way. The rally that was held on the Mall last week, how many of you were there? How many were in Washington? Just a few of you. It was a pretty amazing thing. I mean, there were challenges. We had to fight to get a bigger peace representation in the official part of the program. But at the end of the day, it really didn't matter what was in the official program. What mattered was all these people who brought their signs from home saying jobs, not war. All the people that were running around on the outsides of the rally snatching up posters and literature and stickers that said jobs, not war, that said stop funding the wars, bring home the troops. That's what was so amazing about 100,000 people on the Mall saying that and hearing it and responding to that. And of course, we had Harry Belafonte saying it great. So. But I think that we're at a moment when we're starting to come back to Afghanistan. You know, we heard recently from, was it General Petraeus? It was one of the big guys in the Pentagon saying, oh, no, I think it was Gates, the defense secretary, who said, we're really just getting started in Afghanistan now. And it's like, hello, we've been there for almost 10 years. And you're saying we're just getting started? And it's, you know, they're asking us to believe that, oh, those guys did it all wrong. Oh, okay, they killed all the wrong people. We're going to do it right. We're going to do it better because we're going to just do it more. That's basically what we're talking about. More young people are being drafted. Don't let anyone tell you we don't have a draft in this country. It's not a legal draft. It's a poverty draft. It's a draft of no opportunity. It's a draft of no money for college. It's a draft of no other jobs available. I was with the Iraq Veterans Against the War a few weeks ago at their national conference in Austin, Texas. And I heard a story that was the most horrific I've heard lately, although there's so many, they sort of compete with each other. A young kid, 20 years old, had just finished his military service. He had a short stint and was able to get out. And he realized both his parents had just lost their jobs, and he had no health care. And he needed health care now because of what had happened to him in Iraq, because he could get it for the VA, but his parents had nothing. He needed to be able to provide them with health care. He had to get back to the military so he'd be able to provide health care for his family. Now, that's one hell of a reason. What does that say about our country? That somebody is forced to go back to fight a war they don't want to be fighting, that's not making their family safer because it's the only way to get their family health care. That's what we're dealing with, but we're already having a different kind of discourse because of all that. We have more casualties in Iraq this year already than we did last year all year. And that was the highest year of U.S. casualties and the highest year of Afghan casualties other than the very first year of the war. So the casualties are going up. And what do we hear? We hear, well, that's because it's working. That's because we're sending more troops. Yeah, and what's happening? They're killing more people. They're dying more. And that's supposed to make us safer? Who is safer exactly? I mean, this is, look at what we have right now. We have 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. We have 50,000 still in Iraq. And in Afghanistan, we have 112,000 Pentagon-paid mercenaries. Now, a lot of them are Afghans. A lot of them are from other countries. They're not all U.S. mercenaries, and they're not all paid the $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year salaries that the big shot mercenaries are, but a bunch of them are. 112,000 are in Iraq today. And how many government civilian workers do we have? 1,050. And we're talking about rebuilding Afghanistan. Well, how are we going to do it? The military is going to do it. That's where the money is. That's where we have trained people. What's wrong with this picture? You know, it's interesting. I was, last year sometime, a group of us from my institute were invited to the Pentagon, of all places. It was very weird. We couldn't quite figure out what it meant that they invited us there. We thought it was very weird that we were there and very weird that they let us out. But we had a fascinating discussion. It was scheduled for an hour. It went on for 2.5 hours. We heard later that people in the Pentagon, a lot of them were talking about this meeting, and they were all saying things like it was the most fresh air there's been in this place in years. But what was interesting about it was that it was a far more wide-ranging discussion than we actually had with the people from the State Department and the White House and the NSC, where they were officially, you know, this was all kind of on the quiet. But one of the parts of it that was the most interesting was when we got into an argument, I got into an argument with one of these guys about the relationship between military and humanitarian work. And his line was, we've got to have the military there to protect the humanitarian people. And I said, no, you don't. That's when you fail. And he said, yes, we do, because then otherwise they're in danger. You know, how do you protect humanitarian aid workers? We have to have the military doing it. And I said, you really want me to tell you the story of what happens when you blur the boundary between humanitarian and military work? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, first of all, you people keep complaining why you can't. He had been saying, the problem we have is we can't get anybody to come do the humanitarian work. We can't get any volunteers. We're trying to double, triple, quadruple the humanitarian presence in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and we can't find anybody, we can't recruit anybody. I said, and that surprises you? And he said, yeah, what about all these people who say they want to help the Afghans? I say, yeah, those people don't want to do it on your watch while you're slaughtering people. They don't want to be part of that. No, you know, I said, your job is to kill people and break things. And two of them around the table sort of went, and one of them said, we like to call it kinetic activity. So I said, okay, as long as we understand that kinetic activity means killing people and breaking things, we can call it kinetic activity. So I said, okay, your job is kinetic activity. The job of humanitarian aid workers is to pick up the pieces and help people rebuild their lives. Now, what the humanitarian aid worker worth her salt is going to want to do that under the rubric of the military? No wonder you can't find anybody. And he said, well, we've got to do it. I said, oh, then look what happens there. And I told him the story of the yellow food packets. Some of you know this story. I understand it was in Greg Mortensen's book, which I confess I never read, but it was actually in my book first, so I get to brag about it. Here's the story. In the first weeks of the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. is bombing Afghanistan. It's out of control, and there are huge streams of refugees looking for shelter, just streaming out of cities, out of villages where the bombing is happening. And they're streaming up into the mountains for safety, but it's cold already. This is in November, December. It's really cold. It's very high up. And people are freezing and starving because they have no food. They're on the roads. They're desperate. And so there's a call for getting food to people in these refugee flows. And the U.S. decides, look, we're getting a lot of bad press around the world for this bombing, because it's killing a lot of civilians, obviously. So what we're going to do, we're going to drop food to the people that are fleeing. And so they prepare, and the experienced humanitarian workers go to them and say, this is insane. You're going to miss the most important groups of people. Most of it is not going to be usable when it drops. It's not going to work. This is not the way to do it. And it's going to cost way more money than it would cost to get food by ground to the people who really need it. And they said, well, too bad. This is going to be great press. We're going to show U.S. planes, war planes, dropping food. So they prepare meals ready to eat, right? And they were very careful about being culturally sensitive. They were halal. They were things like peanut butter, very familiar to all Afghans. And they had instructions about how to open them and how to use them, written in three languages, English, French, and Spanish. Very useful in Afghanistan. And they were wrapped in bright yellow plastic to protect them when they were dropped from planes. And they were dropped all over, and people would run to get some of these MREs. It was all the food they had. Well, you know what's coming. It turns out that the bombs that were being dropped, many of them were anti-personnel bombs, bomblets, that have a bright yellow wrapping around them. And 10% of them don't explode when they're dropped, and they become landmines. And children often pick them up because they look a little bit like toys. And that's enough to trigger them, and they blow up, and children are killed, adults lose legs, arms, cows are blown up. And those bombs, yes, are wrapped in exactly the same bright yellow plastic. And it got bad enough, there were enough questions emerging at the Pentagon briefings every day, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Tommy Frank at the time, was forced to make a statement about it. And what he said was, we're making an announcement in Pashto and in Dari. My words will be translated and broadcast on radios, telling people that the community of nations is bombing the bad guys in your country, and we're also dropping food. So be very careful, because they look alike. And some of the journalists said, when are you going to stop the bombing? When are you going to stop sending food that looks the same as the bombs? And he said, well, we're going to stop very soon, as soon as we use up all the food that's already in the pipeline. That's what happens when you blur military and humanitarian work. And as soon as I started to tell that story at the Pentagon, I saw people kind of, they knew this story. So we have a huge problem on our hands right now. We have a huge escalation going on. The offensive in Kandahar is finally underway. You know, we've been hearing about this offensive that was supposed to happen in Kandahar for more than a year now, and it had to be delayed and delayed. The opening round, which happened in a little town called Marja, well, it turns out it didn't work. You know, this idea, we're going to bring a government in a box. We're going to clear out the Taliban, we're going to hold it, and then we're going to build a government. Well, so they built a government. This is a Pashtun area, right? They did get a Pashtun guy to, at least he speaks the same language, to be the new mayor in a box. It's like a jack-in-the-box. You know, he pops up as soon as the U.S. troops have done their work. And he pops up and says, hey, everybody, I'm here to be your new mayor. And people are looking at him like, hello, who's this guy? Who comes from a Pashtun area across the country and had spent the last 15 years in exile in Germany. That's how the U.S. met him. He was one of these people that, you know, knows all the right people. Well, what a surprise. The government in a box didn't really work. And Marja is still very far from being pacified. So it took a very long time. They've now launched this offensive. They're clearing districts outside the city. They're now in the combat phase. There are 12,000 troops in Kandahar alone, in this one not very big city. And the goal is to convince people that they should support the legitimate government. Well, this legitimate government that we're supporting is only legitimate because it's our favorite warlords. I keep wanting to say landlords, but it's warlords. They're sort of landlords, too. They own half the land. They've stolen much of the rest. This is a government that is thoroughly corrupt. And people say, well, we have to stay there to keep that government in power. Well, why exactly? If we're not there and this government fell, would that be such a bad thing, given that it represents exactly nobody except us? This is a serious problem. You all saw or heard about, I think, the cover of Time magazine 2 weeks ago or a month ago, I guess it was, that had that horrifying picture of that gorgeous young Afghan woman whose face had been disfigured by maybe Taliban, maybe other militants in a tiny village in Afghanistan. And the headline was, "What happens if we leave?" And I wanted to shake whoever agreed to that, because the point is, this isn't about when we leave. This is about what happens because we're there. This is about what happens under occupation. This is perhaps the most important and in some ways difficult position on why some people think we need to stay in Afghanistan. Because what will happen to the women? Well, here's one way to look at it. Women in Afghanistan have a pretty short and brutish life, to coin a phrase. The average lifespan in Afghanistan today is about 44 years, but women don't usually live that long. But the vast majority of women who die too young in Afghanistan don't die at the hands of the Taliban. They die in childbirth. Now, in the year 2000, when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan, Afghanistan was the second worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and think she was going to live. Second worst. Sierra Leone was the only country where it was worse. Sierra Leone has gotten better. They're now up to number 5. Where do you think Afghanistan is after 9 years of U.S. occupation in the name of defending Afghan women? We are still exactly number 2. We have improved exactly not at all. Afghanistan is still the second worst country in the world for a woman to live after giving birth. And in terms of children, it has gone from being the second worst place for a child to survive to her first or fifth birthday. We're now the worst in Afghanistan. Under an almost decade of U.S. occupation, Afghan children now die in their first year more than children anywhere else in the world. So anyone who tells you that we have to stay there for the women, I think that's often a pretty good answer. We hear from General Petraeus, also, we are just beginning. The counterinsurgency that I invented, of course, he wants to add. The counterinsurgency is just beginning. It could go on for 8 or 10 years. And that's what he's saying already in anticipation of those who will say to President Obama, you can't pull out now. The counterinsurgency is just beginning. It's just starting to work. Right? This is what we can expect next July when we get to the moment that President Obama has said, we want to at least begin to look at the possibility that we could consider thinking about whether some people might want to maybe pull out 5 people. That's really the only commitment he made. But even that is going to be condemned as making it impossible for the U.S. to continue the war. Let me give you one other set of statistics that I found very interesting that I only learned a couple days ago. The number of people that are internally displaced inside Afghanistan, now this is aside from 2 million refugees in Pakistan, 1 million in Iran, and another million or so scattered in other places, 4 million refugees outside the country. Just the people that are displaced within their country. Back in May of 2008, there were 150,000 displaced people in Afghanistan. As of March of this year, 329,000, more than twice as many. So this whole impact on the people of Afghanistan is what you see here. It's not what you read in the papers, that we got a school going. It's great. We've turned the tide. The tide is still sweeping away people's lives in Afghanistan. We had an election that was filled with corruption. We have a government that can't govern. I mean, they call Karzai the mayor of Kabul, barely. His family is the most powerful family right now, and his family is deep, deep into the corruption. And now he's negotiating with the Taliban. Why shouldn't he? We're paying the Taliban. It turns out that most of these guard agencies, the Afghan guards that are protecting the convoys bringing gasoline, for instance, to U.S. troops scattered around the country that they need to kill Taliban members, are being paid to the Taliban to allow the convoys to go through. So it's like we're paying all sides, we're killing all sides. Who benefits? There's the old saying, follow the money. Who benefits are the corporations that build the planes and make the bombs? They're the ones who benefit. They're the only ones who benefit. We don't benefit here at home. It doesn't make us any safer. People in Afghanistan certainly don't benefit. So the question is, what's the alternative? Somebody asked me the other night, I was speaking somewhere, it was on this TV show. I was saying something about how we need to get out. And the interviewer said, well, tell me how you would do it. How would you get out? And I said, look, I'm not a military logistician. I'm not going to sit here and tell you, well, this company would leave first and this one, that. I'd say you get out the same way you got in, on planes and trains and trucks and feet and donkeys. You group into your bases and you head for the exits. We know where the exits are. They're called borders. And we start moving out. And first we declare a ceasefire as we go. That's the safest way to get our troops out, to stop them from fighting. They won't be attacked as much. Will some be attacked? Maybe, perhaps. But they'll mostly be a lot safer if they're moving out and once they get out. The drone strikes in Pakistan are making our troops hated more than ever before. The drone strikes in other countries is having the same impact. What we have on our side is public opinion. Public opinion is not what it was when Oscar was talking about how so many people supported the war at the beginning. It's true. But now it's different. 58% of people in this country think the war is wrong and should be ended. 78% say that about Iraq. Now that's not enough. We need to get that up to 75% from 58%. That's not going to be enough either. So we need some alternative strategies here. What do we do? It's clear that the military isn't listening to us, the Pentagon isn't, the White House isn't. We have to keep pressuring there for sure. We have to keep pressuring Congress. We have to stop them from spending money on these wars. But that isn't all that's going to be needed. It doesn't always work, as we know. Those of you who have done congressional work for a long time, you know how hard that is. There are other centers of power and influence in this country. We have to not only get the percentage of people who are against this war from 58% up to 78%, we need to be going to the university presidents, to mayors, to city councils, passing resolutions. How many of you were involved in one of the Cities for Peace resolutions in the early days of the war in Iraq? It's time to bring that back. It's time to bring that back. By the end of that campaign, we had 380 cities across the country that had passed resolutions saying we do not support and we will not support an illegal war in Iraq. We want our National Guard to come home. Remember, it was the governor of Montana, hardly a lefty, who was the first governor to demand that the Montana National Guard be brought home. Why? Not because he was in principle against the war in Iraq, because he knew he was going to have a really bad fire season in 2004, and he wanted them back home to fight the fires. We've got a fire raging in our cities. It's the fire of poverty. It's the fire of joblessness. And we need those National Guard troops back here. We need those first responders back in our communities. We need to be spending that money not on the war that's not making anybody safer, but on rebuilding our schools and our roads and putting people back to work. And that means the government's going to ultimately have to put people back to work. This is going to have to look something like the WPA, because the private sector sure as hell isn't doing it. The corporations sure aren't doing it. So the government's going to have to do it, and they're going to tell us there's no money. Hello, there's $1 trillion this year alone. If you add up the cost of the military budget, the separate budget to fight the wars, I always want to say, well, what's the military budget if it doesn't include fighting wars? The military budget is $847 billion, and it doesn't include fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Hello, how does that work? I don't know, but that's how they figure it. But if you add those two together and then add the military cost of the nuclear weapons arsenal, it goes over $1 trillion just for this year. So our call is move the money. The money's there. Don't talk about cutting Social Security and Medicare. Talk about cutting the military. That's going to make us all a lot safer. We had, after this amazing rally last week. We had another amazing meeting. It's not often that I call meetings amazing, because I go to way too many meetings, as I imagine most of you do too. But this was an amazing meeting, not least because it was 9 o'clock in the morning, the day after this amazing march and rally, when everybody had gone out for a beer afterwards and had been celebrating all night with Alice Walker at a big event in Washington, and up dancing and singing all night. But people came in. It was people from a dozen different unions, about a dozen peace organizations, and about a dozen community-based anti-racist and immigrant rights organizations that came together to say, how do we build a movement to move the money, to end the military budget, and get the money back into our communities? And we actually started some pretty good work. There's going to be a website soon. There were people from AFSC there. There were people from all around the country. It was a pretty amazing moment, not because anything enormous happened right at that time, but because it gave us some hope that there's some possibility here. There's some possibility to start now. Even though this war has been going on for 10 years, our movement hasn't been where it needs to be. We're getting there now. We're getting there. This rally was just the beginning. And yeah, even though the official part of it didn't say as much as we would have wanted about the impact of the wars and the impact of the military budgets, that was there, and the people that were there went home with that message. Now's our job to go back and remobilize all those people, not to show up in Washington again, not just to vote. Yeah, you have to do all that, but voting alone never makes it. Voting alone never makes it. So we need to move towards a demand to end the military role in Afghanistan so that we can begin to make good. This is the alternative. When we talk about, well, what alternative is there? You can't just cut and run. Well, that was a slogan that, despite it being used to justify the war in Iraq, there was a lot to it that made sense. We can't just cut and run. We've done way too much damage in these countries. We owe the peoples of Iraq and Afghanistan a huge debt. But we can't begin to make good on that debt until we get the military out. You can't do both at the same time. So for all that Colin Powell used to talk about Pottery Barn, we broke it, we own it. You know, Iraq and Afghanistan are not cups. They're countries. And the U.S. military is not a tube of crazy glue. The right analogy is not the Pottery Barn broken cup. It's the bull in the china shop. What do you do when the bull gets loose in the china shop and breaks half the cups? You don't leave the bull in the china shop and ask the bull nicely to repair the cups. You get the bull the hell out of the china shop and write a check for the damage. That's step one. That's just step one. Then, how do we support global and regional diplomacy, real reparations, real compensation? It's not going to be easy. But until we end the war, we can't even begin to make good. So that's what I think we need to talk about tonight. How do we move forward? How do we end the war? How do we make good on what we owe to the peoples of Iraq and Afghanistan? Thank you.
All right, thank you both. Okay, so the format for questions is... I'll take a stack, so if you have a question and want to raise your hand, I'll call on you. Before we do that, there's one part of this exhibit that I hadn't mentioned earlier, and that's a number of drawings from Afghan high school students that were collected over the summer that we have in the corner. And we actually received about 50 drawings. And we tried to sort of choose the most powerful. But what we did do is we tried to notice how often certain themes came up in the drawings. And you'll see from the ones we've chosen that one of the biggest themes for Afghan high school students were amputations. And there was a stunning number of drawings depicting that. And the other point that Phyllis was talking about was the violence against women. And it sort of reminded all of us who looked at those photos, those drawings, that for Afghan women, it doesn't matter if it's a Norwegian troop or a Taliban soldier or a private militia or the Afghan army or a U.S. soldier. The uniforms don't matter. The ongoing war has created an extraordinary culture of violence or an extraordinary life of violence for these young people. So do take a look at those drawings. They're very powerful. We have about 20 minutes or so for questions, and then I also want to give people a chance to purchase a book if you like before Phyllis needs to leave for a train back to Washington. Wow. I can't imagine all your questions were answered, Joyce.
Well, I just wondered if the group that met the day after last week really does have some next steps, because I think a lot of people are willing to take steps but not feeling that we actually have a lead on what to do, and that is important to hear.
I mean, we do have some of the, that's a great question. I'll let Phyllis answer it, but I also there's already been some collaboration with groups all over the country, and so there's a lot of different names. So some of you may have seen it as a 25% campaign. That was Congressman Barney Frank had some time ago said, if we're going to be serious about reducing the deficit that this country faces, we need to have everything on the table. The Obama administration originally said everything but the military is on the table. So his initial thing was cut 25% from the Pentagon. And so a lot of groups have already sort of organized around that. My sense is that there will be less of a number like that, and that something more effective is move the dollars. But there's some steps that people have already taken. Some of you who get our messages will know that we were urging people to contact our representatives here to support a letter that Barney Frank and Ron Paul were drafting and submitting to this committee that's going to look at ways to reduce the budget. So that's one thing that's happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this... this is the critical question is what's the follow-up? And at that particular meeting, which, as Peter said, was, I think, the fourth or fifth in a series of differing coalitions that were coming together in different places and different times, people were being quite modest and saying, we're not going to try and create a new organization here today, or even formally a new network, but there were lots of lists being exchanged. So there's four working groups, one on messaging, one on coordination of resources, because there's campaigns like the 25% campaign in a number of arenas, all on this sort of theme of move the money away from the military to human needs. Some are very specific, focusing on jobs or focusing on the environment. Some are broader, just fund human needs in lots of different ways. A lot of people are using the idea was that these are local campaigns. And I think the notion of city and state-based campaigns are going to be the most effective right now. There's incredibly useful material on the website of the National Priorities Project, which I urge you all to take a look at. It's one of these websites that you have to know what you want, but it's actually very easy to use. What they give you is a breakdown of sets of military spending. So you can choose the Afghan war from day one until the present, the Iraq war from day one to the present, Iraq and Afghanistan together, the entire military budget. You have like five or six choices. Then you plug in your city, your state, or your congressional district. I think it's by city, state, and county, maybe. And what it will tell you is how much tax money, say Philadelphia, how many millions, or maybe over a billion, I'm betting, how much money has Philadelphia spent on these wars in the last 10 years? And what the part of it that's great is it will then tell you 5 or 10 different examples of how else could that amount of money be spent. So say it was, you know, $100 million. $100 million could have paid for X number of firefighters to be hired, X number of school teachers to be hired, X number of children placed in Head Start, X number of low-income people given health care, X number of houses provided with green energy, efficient energy. You know, you can choose, or you can use all of them as examples. So it's a great resource. You don't have to do any of the research. It's all right there with just a couple of clicks on a website, nationalpriorities.org. So there was the collaboration with resources. We're going to be contacting the leadership of the One Nation Working Together rally, who at this moment are still not sure they're even going to remain together as a particular coalition. But some of those key organizations, the NAACP, the SEIU, National Council of La Raza, some of these other key constituencies that were involved in that, we're going to be trying to contact them as well to link them to this campaign. And I think that we'll do better this time because I think they will have seen how the issue of the military budget has this dramatically terrible effect on every single arena of struggle, whether you're working for jobs, whether you're working for immigration reform. In all of these arenas, the distortion of the budget that comes from the cost of these wars, even before you start talking about the human cost. And it's organizations, of course, like AFSC that has been and remains the centerpiece of the moral core of the peace movement. While I think it is appropriate and important that we focus a lot on the cost of war, because that's what's going to get these wars ended sooner, we can't abandon the commitment to the victims of the war, particularly the victims in the countries where we go to war, as well as people who are forced to fight them here, but especially the victims there.
First Celeste and then Joanne.
Well, I want to ask you, knowing the people that you know within the government structure, do you sense that there are allies within the White House or the State Department who can be approached, who can be supported, who can actually create alliances with the peace community?
The question was whether there seem to be people in the White House, in the administration, somewhere that seem more open to the ideas of the peace community, whether they could be supported, etc. It's a really good question, and I wish I had a better answer. The answer, as far as I can tell, is not very many. Some of my colleagues who work on other issues, on labor issues, even on immigration, on the environment, while we can't look at particular victories of the administration, there are people in there that have decent positions, some of whom come out of social movements that we work with. But on the issues of the wars and occupations, no, we don't see it. I don't know of a single person. Frankly, the closest we came to that was in the Pentagon, where there were a couple, interestingly, of people who had joined the Pentagon thinking that that might be a place they could have some influence away from the militarism as the centerpiece of policy. I haven't seen any in the White House or in anywhere else. And I don't know of anyone who comes out of any of our movements who was called to participate in that way. So, no.
Can I ask a different kind of question? I'm a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War through my husband and my brother. At any rate, I know the work that they are doing, coffee houses, reaching out to veterans. But do you know if they or any other comparable veterans group are reaching out to the people most affected, the mothers and fathers of those who have lost people in Afghanistan? Mm-hmm. Not so that their hearts will bleed for Afghanis, because they do not, but what about their own self-interest? Another thing I want to bring up is what about the millions of people who are working in war industries? Whoever reaches them, they're damn glad to have a job, and they don't question what they're doing. I'd like to know how you reach out to them.
Yeah, these are very important and difficult questions. The first about what kind of outreach IVAW and other related organizations are doing to families of service members. And I think Celeste is one of our pioneers in that entire arena. But the organization's Military Families Speak Out, which was created before the war in Iraq began, shortly after the war in Afghanistan had just been launched, and one of its chapters, of course, Gold Star Families Speak Out, which is the families who have lost loved ones in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, have done absolutely extraordinary work in bringing that human face of the cost of war at home, the human cost of the war, and it is MFSO with IVAW together, along with Veterans for Peace, that still have a bigger generational range, shall we say, that together have provided them so much of the moral center of and the face of the peace movement, the ones with the unquestioned legitimacy. And it is their relationship with the great organization, September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, that has made that link between the Afghan victims, the Iraqi victims, and the victims here at home. The IVAW, for instance, Iraq Veterans Against the War, has three parts to their core demands. The first is bring all the troops home. The second is take care of them when they get home. And the third is reparations for the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. So they make those links. The work of organizations like Military Families Speak Out and Gold Star Families Speak Out are the center of that. The question of the... what was the first part of the question? The workers in the defense industry. This is a very tough one. There is work going on. There was recently a huge campaign at a factory in upstate New York. I think it was up near Corning. I forget where. In a major defense contracting company, a big factory, that was faced with the possibility that if a certain... weapon system was not supported, that their factory would close down. And they were looking at the issue of conversion. How do you, it's not that hard to convert a line, a production line, to produce, for example, solar panels. And a study that was done by colleagues of mine at IPS indicated that when you compare the number of jobs that can be created in military industries versus green technologies, you get about a 20-to-1 ratio in favor of the green technologies. You get a lot more jobs created out of the same amount of money. The challenge is, of course, it doesn't happen overnight. And there is no easy answer for the people who today make a living, whether they're machinists or teamsters, whose living depends on their making F-16 fighter bombers. There is no easy answer to that. We can talk all we want about conversion, and we need to, because it's a very realistic and very, not easy, but it's certainly not a difficult technological challenge. It is a difficult military challenge, and political challenge. And the reason it's so difficult is because the military has been brilliant at politicking. And what that means is they have orchestrated a situation in which almost every major weapons and weapons system in the U.S. is built not in one place, but scattered around the country, the most inefficient production possible, where one piece is, one little thread is made over here, and a bobbin is made over there, and a nail is made over there, and the screwdriver is made over there. And it's in every single, right, it's in every single congressional district. That's the challenge we face. So even the so-called anti-war Democrats are not prepared to vote against almost any military spending because almost all of them would be faced with the accusation that they're voting away, even if it's 10 jobs in their district, let alone if it's 3,000 jobs in their district. It's a huge challenge. But we have to get the issue of of conversion back on the agenda as a legitimate thing. We need to be doing in the engineering schools. There need to be people writing their doctoral dissertations on how do you convert a bomber production line to a solar panel production line or whatever, you know, whatever's the equivalent. So that's the goal. There's no easy answers, but I would say that for all of the concerns that we heard at the rally about unions that were afraid to hear anything about the war, that was the reason. That was the reason we were given, the reason it couldn't be more present. All those unions were there. They didn't seem to have any problem. I didn't hear any booing from the machinists when there were anti-war speakers. So I think maybe some of their leaders have been far more afraid than the members. So it's always the grassroots. Yeah.
We did the reverse in World War II. Because we needed it, we converted our factories to war-making machines. We can do it backwards. We just need the momentum coming from the White House. It's that simple.
That's a very good point. I hadn't really thought of it that way before. The point was that we could do it backwards from the way it happened in World War II. In World War II, there was an urgent need, and so all these production facilities were transformed into war production. You could just reverse them back the same way if you have the political will. A very good point. It's something we should be holding President Obama to, another lesson to learn from FDR, the way he sometimes has talked about, although it hasn't happened quite so much, when FDR was told by all these social movements, by the trade unions, by the community organizers, by the communists, by the church activists, by everybody, here's what you need to be doing to end racism, to put people to work. And he said, all right, you people, I get it. I know what I need to do. Now you go out there and make me do it. That has to be our job.
Two more minutes.
Joanne.
You hear a lot of talk from the right about cutting taxes, cutting spending, except for keeping our country safe. That's the line, and that's kind of tacked on. How do you, is anybody talking about the safety issue?
That's a very good point. I would just say, I know people have to leave, this I think will be our last question, but I'm just urging that people, as you leave, take a look at the books. I really don't want to have to drag them all home. A lot of people are talking about these wars in the context of whether they make us safer. And the reality is, they don't. They don't. They, you know, if there is one way you could look at it, which is a sort of fun way, and it gets the attention of some people, which is to say, if we went to Afghanistan to get rid of Al-Qaeda and kill off the Taliban that was welcoming Al-Qaeda there, we've done that. The CIA says there's less than 50 members of Al-Qaeda in the entire country of Afghanistan. And in the entire country of Pakistan, which is a bit much bigger target, there's less than 300. So for 350 people, we're sending 100,000 and 112,000 mercenaries? That doesn't sound like a very useful use of resources. And the question is, we've wiped out Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. If that was the goal, I don't happen to think it was, but for those who do think it was and think that's why we had to be there, say, okay, then you can declare victory and get out telling the truth. Unlike in Vietnam when we just kept telling people, declare victory and get out. They can say it and it'll be true. They succeeded at wiping out the presence of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So get out. Then you can start the discussion about what do you do when Al-Qaeda shows up somewhere else, like Hamburg or London. You have a very different approach. You don't think about going to war. So, you know, so that's, I think that it's not a difficult, in our book, I did the book with David Wildman, who works for the Methodists in New York, the Afghanistan book, and one of the areas that we looked at is, does it make us safe? And it gives all the reasons why it doesn't. So that it's not a hard argument to make. There's fear, and we have to be very careful not to make fun of that. It's very real. People are frightened. This is a frightening time. Terrorism is real. Is that stopping terrorism? No, it's increasing terrorism as a result. There's terrorism spreading as a result. There's more terrorism, not less. You can't use a military, conventional army to fight your way against terrorists. It doesn't work that way. It has the opposite effect. So it's not to say that we do nothing about terrorism. We have to be serious about that. But a war is not the way to answer it. I think that's the answer. I think we need to end, because it's getting late. There are books for sale. And do you want to finish with a few words?
Yeah,
no,
I think okay. You summed it up.
Anyway, thank you.
Just going to call from the crowd.